This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. This week, the family of the late Strom Thurmond, the long-serving senator from South Carolina, acknowledged that he'd fathered a daughter nearly 80 years ago, Essie Mae Washington Williams. Her mother was the Thurmond family's 16-year-old African-American maid. Through much of his political career, Strom Thurmond was a staunch segregationist. While he was alive, the senator, his daughter, and several others kept this all secret. Ms. Williams' children encouraged her to come forward, and she says the truth has lifted a great burden. Later in the program, we'll go to Chesapeake, Virginia, and talk about the difficulties that face the jury weighing the fate of sniper suspect Lee Boyd Malvo. But first, family secrets. What do we hide and why? What should be told and what shouldn't? And where's the line between secrecy and privacy? And while we want to broaden the discussion to families in general, we begin with the Thurmond family secret. Joining us by phone from Los Angeles is author and political analyst Earl Afari Hutchinson. His most recent book is The Crisis in Black in Black. And welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Well, also my pleasure.
You've written that this is a personal story for you and your family. How so?
Well, actually, two reasons. Number one, my granddaughters happen to be, we did find out, the great-great-granddaughters of the late Senator Strom Thurmond. So obviously there's a personal connect there. The second thing is it had long been rumored in the family that there was a connect between Strom Thurmond and, in this case, a close personal family friend of mine, which happens to be the great-grandmother of my granddaughters. And we knew that there was something there in the sense that indications had been made that she had a relationship with Strom Thurmond. And then from there, we just deduced that that relationship was more than just a friendly relationship, namely, in this case, a father-daughter relationship. So it had been kind of swirling around in the family for a long time, the knowledge of that. And then, of course, the confirmation the other day. Even then, there was a bit of a surprise because it's still kind of registering now that we could have this kind of relationship in our family to a Strom Thurmond, given who he is and, of course, much of the legacy of Strom Thurmond in the South.
And you also face a problem in the future, do you not?
Well, there's a couple of problems. Number one, we have to be very careful with the, in this case, great-grandchildren and the grandchildren. Because if it's not explained properly to them, namely who Strom Thurmond was, what the relationship to the family is, exactly where they fit into the larger scheme of this, because remember, they're very, very young, mm-hmm. then you have a situation there where children being children may not understand. There could be some confusion, even bitterness, because we have certainly seen a lot of that in the bitterness and rancor that goes on in the Jefferson family between the blacks and the whites. So we don't want that kind of situation arising in our family.
Sir, you're referring to President Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings and that whole mess in that family where people refuse to acknowledge and nobody invites each other. And
Exactly.
your family, though, you say this was swirling around. You know, something the experts say is that families don't really keep secrets, that everybody kind of knows.
Mm-hmm. Well, in this case, we did know because as we did find out, it had been on the web. There had been articles that had been written on this before. And as a matter of fact, in the unauthorized biography of Strom Thurmond called Old Strom, there was considerable space mentioned in the book about the possible relationship of this woman, Essie Mae Washington Williams, to Strom Thurmond, in fact, that he was her daughter. So it was already there, not only in terms of the family and what we knew about it in terms of the folklore, but also in the public domain, too. So it's not exactly like this was a secret of the ages. People had been talking about this for a long period of time, and we certainly had been talking about it in our family.
Will, when the time comes, will you be the, I don't know whether you're going to be the one to tell your grandchildren or not, but will they be told about Strom Thurmond as segregationist, Strom Thurmond as a Dixiecrat candidate, Strom Thurmond as an emblem of the Republican revival in the South? Will they be told as Strom Thurmond, who late in his career changed his mind about many things?
Well, all of the above. And even now, one of my granddaughters, in fact, the older one, when the story first broke, the first thing she said was, who is this Strom Thurmond guy? So I'm in the position right away without going into any great detail because, let's face it, we're talking about someone who's only 8 years old. At this point in time, not to get into the issues of states' rights and conservatism and segregation, just trying to say you've got a celebrated individual in your family who happens to be your great-great-grandfather, and there's controversy around him. But even so, given his political record, his political legacy, the bottom line is he's still a family member, for better or for worse.
And is it better, all things considered, that it's out, or do you think it might have been better if somehow it could all have been kept quiet?
No, I don't think it should be kept quiet. I think in this situation, whether we're talking about a family revelation, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and others, or in terms of the public domain, what the public has a right to know, it should be out there because, let's face it, children need to know about their heritage, the good and the bad, and also something else, too. The public needs to know. It peels back a very bitter and a very hidden part of the South, namely interracial sexual relations between prominent, wealthy white Southerners, men, and also black women. And I think it needs to be out there, and it needs to be exposed to the public light.
Earl Afari Hutchinson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Earl Afari Hutchinson is an author and political analyst. His most recent book is The Crisis in Black and Black, and he joined us on the phone from Los Angeles. Well, few family secrets are as dramatic or as public as the Thurmans, but they are common. Mom's depression, an uncle's drinking problem, extramarital affairs, sexual abuse, adoption. Each family carries secrets. Hiding them can cause emotional scars across generations. Disclosure can lift a weight or sometimes tear a family apart. Is there a secret in your family? Has it come to light? Why or why not? Are some secrets better kept secret? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now is author James McBride, whose book, The Color of Water, A Black Man's Tribute to His White Mother, explored his realization that his mom was a white Orthodox Jew who had raised a black Baptist family. And James McBride joins us on the phone from his home in Pennsylvania. And it's good of you to be with us today.
Thank you for having me. Delighted to be here.
Was this a secret? In what sense was this a secret?
You mean about my mother?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, she refused to talk about her history. I mean, it was clear at a certain point that she was not black like the other women in the neighborhood, but the fact that she refused to talk about it was kind of lost because our issues had to do with, you know, more with poverty and more with trying to just feed ourselves. So it wasn't, I guess you could call it an open secret, although I'm still hoping that somehow I'm really the son of, you know, J. Paul Getty or somebody really, you know, with a lot of money.
Now, when did you realize your mom was different from the other moms?
When I was probably about 5 or 6 years old, and the bus came, she was standing at a bus stop, and the bus pulled up, and I realized that, you know, she didn't look like anybody else's mother who was standing there. I lived in an all-black neighborhood in New York, and I looked out the window, and I just realized that she didn't look like anybody else. And so I asked her about it, and she was very evasive. And that evasiveness lasted for, until I was a grown man.
Did that evasiveness make you feel uneasy?
Yeah, but, you know, and I think, yeah, I think it did, but I don't think it... I think it affected me in some ways, but I can't really say that it made me a bad person.
No, I'm not a bad person, but did it make you wonder what the secret might be? What's going on here?
Oh, yeah, I mean, sure. But again, you know, our issues had more to do with food than anything else. I mean, we didn't really have the time to think about these identity issues. And in some ways, that's a real middle class issue, and that's not. It doesn't mean it's not important, but for us, the fact that our mother was different was we were in a little bit defensive about it because we kind of had to. She created the world. She was the beginning, the end, and the middle. So whatever she said was gospel. And if she said that she was not white, she was black. Well, by God, you just went with that. You know, you had to.
I take it she didn't have her family over very often.
That's right. They weren't there for the high holidays. No, but she never told us that she was Jewish. But, you know, we went to school with a lot of Jewish people. We lived in New York at a time when New York had, you know, a lot more. Well, New York was in our neighborhoods, and the schools that we went to, they were all pretty much primarily Jewish schools. And she made sure that we went to mostly Jewish schools because she felt that that's where a lot of learning took place. And I'm glad she did that. I think that had she divulged the secret of her family, the secret of her background, the fact that she was raised by an Orthodox Jewish rabbi who really didn't deserve the honor of that title, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
But had she divulged her real secrets, you know, her real story to us when we were kids, we wouldn't have been able to handle it anyway. You know, there's a lot to this that is important, and there's a lot to it that's not really important.
When you did find out, did you contact your mother's family? Did you find out about them?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, after The Color of Water became a bestseller, I heard from lots of people. But I have several Jewish cousins.
Several people thinking you were J. Paul Getty.
That's my dream. That's my next The Color of Water Part 2. But I have several Jewish cousins that I've become very close to as a result of The Color of Water being published. I have a cousin in Texas who came with me, who I talk to maybe 3 or 4 times a year. He's met my family, he's met my mother, my brothers and sisters. My mother's cousin in California, who my mother knew as a child, has become very close to us. We have a very large, extended Jewish family, if you will. And we find that we have a lot in common. And we love them very much. And I think the feeling is mutual. Now, there are those on that side and those on my family side, on my side, who are not that enthusiastic about meeting their Jewish counterparts. But at least in the case of my family, that's a very small number. And I think that that's probably the case with most people who have, you know, this kind of situation.
Don't you think now that you're close to these people, wouldn't you have liked to have met them when you were 5 years old?
No, because when I was 5 years old, I wouldn't have understood who they were and what they represented. Because when I was five, I mean, you can't go through, the ifs don't matter. What only matters is what's real, in my opinion. You know, I've been more enriched by knowing them as an adult than I would have ever been knowing them as a child, because as a child, I was shaping my own sense of identity. And that, you know, that sort of dovetails into why my book is so popular with teenagers, because this whole question of identity is a really important one. And I think that's why people go through this exercise of finding out who their relatives are, at least in my case.
The people who've read your book, especially the teenagers, I wonder, do they write you or get in touch with you to talk about their own family secrets, to talk about their confusion about their own identity?
All the time. Well, when I went back to my high school in Queens, Cardozo, which used to be pretty much a Jewish high school, about 55% of that student body is Asian American. And they had some amazing stories to talk about in terms of their identity issues, in terms of what to keep, in terms of their real heritage, and what to leave behind in terms of being a quote unquote, you know, true American. It's the same story for every group that comes here. So yeah, I get letters and emails. I get 20 or 30 emails and letters a month. And I get invitations from high schools and colleges every week. I get an invitation or two to come and visit the school, talk to students, and so forth.
And tell your story.
Yeah, well, not only that, but to talk about these issues of identity and how they're important and how, in some ways, they're not so important.
James McBride, thank you very much for sharing with us today.
Well, thank you.
James McBride's most recent book is out in paperback. It's a novel called Miracle at St. Anna. He also wrote The Color of Water, and he joined us by phone from his home in Pennsylvania. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about family secrets, and of course you're invited to join us. What's the family secret in your clan? What would happen if everybody started talking about it? Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email totn@npr.org. And joining us now is Jason Saffer. He's a marriage and family therapist and co-director of the Center for Creative Growth in Berkeley, California. He's with us from the studios of Youth Radio in Berkeley. And thanks very much for being with us today.
My pleasure, Neil.
If there is a main reason why families carry secrets around for years and years, what would it be?
Well, there's mainly a sense of, or perceived sense, there's going to be a great embarrassment or a sense of shame. if certain information gets revealed. So the human tendency is to, let's see if we can forget about this or not talk about this and put it under the rug. That's often what motivates folks to keep something secret.
In the world of politics, we've all learned over and over and over again, it's not the original crime that's often so bad, it's the cover-up.
That's true. People, we don't like it when people don't tell the truth, particularly when there's something sensed out there that's going on. It can drive us really nuts inside. It really creates a lot of turmoil on the political front, but also within families. A sense that something's going on, I have a sense that something's going on, but no one's talking about it. And it creates a lot of anxiety, and it creates a lot of feelings in children of shame.
And it could be imagining something far worse than what actually is the case.
It's often imagined as far worse, which really adds to the difficulty. And that's why when stuff can get revealed and shared about at appropriate ages for children, for example, it brings a breath of fresh air and great relief.
We've got some callers and some emails lined up, so let's get to it. Our first caller is Emily, who joins us on the phone from Honolulu in Hawaii.
Hi. I am a family secret. Not in my family. I grew up and I'm adopted, but I found my birth mother and about 10 years ago, and I call her intermittently, and I appear to be a very big secret in her family, as she refuses to acknowledge that she knows anything about me. And it's caused a lot of anxiety in me because I'd really like to, talk about the truth with her. And I guess I'm wondering if there's anything I can do to make it easier for her to face that truth with me.
What do you think?
Well, I'm really glad you're raising that issue because the views towards adoption have changed so much in recent years. I think it would be really helpful for your birth mom if you were to approach her, for example, and say, listen, I can well understand that you made decisions back when and there were society influences on you back then that perhaps you felt a lot of shame or embarrassment that you were pregnant and not in a position to raise me as a child. I want to let you know that I can understand and have compassion for you about that. And at the same time, it's helpful for me to learn more about you so I have a sense of my background, my biological heritage, so I can have that part of my life be complete. That might be pave the way for her to feel more open to being able to make a connection with you.
Yeah, that's very good advice, to validate her experience first.
Yes, to validate and bring compassion to her, and that can more likely open her heart to bring compassion and loving energy back towards you.
At the same time, though, Emily, and I don't mean to project, but a lot of adopted children wonder why their birth mother did not love them enough to keep them.
Well, see, that's an assumption that's one of the stigmas attached to adoption, that the birth mother didn't love them enough to keep them. As a matter of fact, what's most often the case is that a birth mother or a birth father loved enough to be able to make an adoption plan for their child so they can be raised in a healthy and a satisfying environment.
But, Emily, was that a question that occurred to you at any point?
Well, I'm actually very educated in the adoption field. I used to be a member of a search and support group, and I ran a support group for adoptees. So intellectually, it's very different than the emotional feelings. Intellectually, I understand completely, where my birth mother's coming from. I understand the pressures that were on her. I understand that it's certainly often the case that it's because people, women or parents, care about their children so much that they do put them up for adoption. But then the other side of that coin is the very primal feeling of, this is my mother on some levels. I have another mother on other levels. There is a longing. But I would have to say no, I don't worry about whether she loved me enough to do one thing or didn't love me enough to do another. I understand the circumstances.
Emily, thanks very much for the call, and good luck.
Okay, thank you.
Appreciate it. Let's go to another caller, and this is Nick, who's with us from Bayville, New Jersey.
Yeah, hi, Scott. The part of dealing with the separation or the not knowing here, I have a I had a father who was in a prisoner of war camp during World War II. I had some other relatives who were in some of the concentration camps, and none of them ever talk about it. Never, ever. And so the aspect of it's almost like a generational thing to where we have Ms. I forgot her name, where Ms. Washington Williams,
mm-hmm.
John Thurman's daughter, who is, you know, of that same generation, and yet she never spoke about it up until now. So that's the question. It's almost like a generational thing because we have a lot of people from that generation who just don't talk about some of the atrocities and some of the wrongs that have been done with them. And, I mean, I have, you know, my father's long gone. He never once spoke about it, even on his deathbed.
Jason Saffer, is this a generational issue to some degree?
Well, you know, it's a generational issue in the sense that when people are adults and parents, they often want to protect, we want to protect our kids from feeling hurt and feeling disturbed. And so we often have this reaction that says, I won't talk about this and I'll kind of put it aside and it really won't affect me or it won't affect my family any longer and I'll protect the children. And that's often a strong motivation for secrets being kept. Unfortunately, though, the energy of there being a secret is felt by family members and by children at some level. And they pick up on it that something's not quite there, or why isn't dad or mom talking about this experience? And kids will often feel that something's wrong with them, or something's wrong with the family, or something's wrong with life. And that's where this feeling of, you know, shame or self-consciousness can develop. So it's an understandable tendency to not want to, you know, burden your children with certain information, and it's certainly appropriate to wait till later in life, you know, when they're able to understand the situation. But kids like to know about their parents' experiences. As I got older in my own life and my father was willing and able to share more about his experience as a World War II combat vet, it drew us much closer together.
Nick, I assume there are still relatives with whom you would like to hear some more.
Oh yes, guys. I'm trying to get an audio archive of some of the things that my mother went through before she came to this country. And you know, sadly, my father's long gone. He went to a prisoner of war camp, so very undocumented type of stuff. He went to a prisoner of war camp in the Russian army, yet where 30,000 men went in and less than 2,000 came out alive. And yet he never told me. There was never even a peep of what he went through during that time. And since he's been gone now for almost 30 years, it is something of a net. There's a lot of questions going on. There are questions that my mother, you know, through their nighttime discussions, my mother has gleaned some information, but even she can't, you know, she can never really delve into what was in my father's mind and what was going on.
Thanks very much for the call.
All righty. Have a good day.
Here's an email we have from Jason Little in Minneapolis. In my family, we have the gay uncle secret. Uncle Joe in Seattle just happens to never have been married and just happens to own a house with another man for decades now and just happens to have an addiction to musical theater. For years, I've tried to lead my mom to saying Uncle Joe is gay, but she changes the subject faster than a speeding bullet. Now that I happen to live with another man and have a flair for musical theater, I've become part of the secret, too. No one talks about it, but everyone knows. Convenient for everyone but my partner, he writes. And there's another email we have, this one from Judy Austin in Boise, Idaho. At the graveside of my grandfather's last surviving sibling, an elderly cousin took my father aside to tell him a deep family secret, that my dad's great-grandfather had been an animal trainer in an itinerant New England carnival. We all thought it was wonderful. The fact that my mother's paternal grandfather hanged himself has never been a secret in that family. Obviously, dark family secrets are a matter of perception. And I guess that's an important point, Jason Saffer.
This is often true because some of the things that people in previous generations, going back, you know, grandfathers, great-grandfathers, et cetera, that were real taboos and really shockers to us now are much, you know, much more accepted and even we find maybe even amusing, but endearing. You know, having a, quote, illegitimate child or out of, quote, wedlock, for example, used to be, or even divorce, not that long ago, was considered to be a great disgrace. And so the social mores change, but the habit of keeping a secret about it persists.
Let's go to KJ, and KJ's with us from St. Paul, Minnesota.
Hi, greetings. What an intriguing topic. And I guess, Jason, something you said really struck a nerve or a chord with me, and that's talking about the shame that children feel when there are secrets. I grew up in a family where there was, you know, just rampant alcoholism and, I mean, you name it, infidelity, arranged marriages, sexual abuse, and, I mean, to top the whole mess off, a fake suicide. And on both sides of our family, everybody just kind of pretended that none of this went on. And as a little girl, I remember just being very aware that something's not right here. Something is not right, and why won't anybody talk about this? And as I became an older woman, I started really, you know, delving into it and doing research and trying to put it all together. And when I finally had it together and just kind of wanted to talk about it, you know, to be made a scapegoat or the black sheep just because of the telling, you know, with no judgment in the telling, just the telling. I guess I'm curious to know, you know, what do people do with this type of thing once they've exposed it and they're ostracized? You know, is there any hope?
Well, you are raising a very, very important question, and I'm glad you're bringing that to our attention. You know, when we get to a place that we want to be able to tell the truth, it's very important to speak to people, whether they be family members or perhaps not family members, who can really hear us and support us, mirror back to us how we feel about it, and who can really validate us. So it's important, you know, not all family members will be able to do that, because the family rule of secrecy can be so strong that people will be willing to sacrifice a family member or demonize them in some sense or push them out and make them wrong and blame them in order to preserve the perception that this family will stay safe. If you can't speak to all family members, or if maybe you can speak to some, speaking to a therapist, speaking to people in your support group or social network, somebody who will be able to hear you and say, you know, I can really feel what you're going through, and it's great that you're telling me. It's such a relief to be able to do that.
And then when still having to deal with family members, just not discussing it?
Sometimes you'd have to have a strategic approach to family members, and some things just don't get discussed. It's kind of like an agreement to we agreed to disagree about this, and we won't talk about it. Mm-hmm. And so that's an area of family life that we don't talk about, but doesn't mean you can't have really good, loving connections in other aspects of one's family life.
Well, thank you, and I'll continue to listen. It's fascinating.
Thanks for the call,
sure.
KJ. Take care, we're speaking with Jason Saffer, a marriage and family therapist and co-director of the Center for Creative Growth in Berkeley, California. We're talking about family secrets, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And I need to ask Jason Saffer, are there times when secrets are better kept?
Well, some things, I'd like to make a distinction between keeping a family secret and also just having a boundary around privacy issues, and that's an important distinction to make. There are certain things that are really people's private business. For example, a husband and wife in a family situation, what's going on for them sexually in their lives or problems or tensions they're having, it doesn't necessarily have to get shared with, you know, their children. It's not necessarily a secret. It's a private matter. In our society, we don't really talk too freely about other people about financial matters, for example. That's not necessarily a secret, but that's something that's just kept private. I guess one of the criteria to keep in mind is if the secret being kept or the information that's being kept generates a sense of shame or self-consciousness or embarrassment in any family member, then it's, I think, worth looking at as something that's really more trouble than it's worth keeping secret.
Something like, though, an extramarital affair maybe decades ago, long over, might cause more pain than relief.
Well, you know, people in 12-step programs, for example, AA or Al-Anon, one of the steps has to do with making amends for past wrongs. And one of the steps, step 9, talk about making direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. And I think that's a good criteria to keep in mind when we approach, does a certain piece of information have to come out? Is this going to cause more harm than good? And that's a guideline that I think is often helpful when trying to make a decision about what to share and what not to share.
Let's go to Kurt, who's with us from Media, Pennsylvania.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm having trouble hearing you, but thank you. My story's are neither as dramatic nor as personal as some of your other callers, but in my own family, there are some secrets that came up as my mom was beginning to do genealogy, having to do a little bit with illegitimate children who were raised as siblings or sisters who raised their sisters' children,
mm-hmm.
and things like that. And when puzzling through the genealogy, the issue is, what do you record as history? And what is considered personal information?
And I guess that goes back to the line between privacy and secrecy, Jason Safran.
Yeah, and in this particular case, some of them, the people are all long gone. And in fact, some of the confirmation of the actual history may in fact be lost. In other cases, the people are still living and have children who are still living. And and what to bring out that's personal and for, in my mom's own case, for medical history, if you wanted to trace back to find out things related to that.
Some possibly genealogical medical information, sure.
Yeah.
Jason Safran?
Well, you know, some things are not meant for public consumption, so it depends what the genealogy, who that's intended for example. Is it for the immediate family or is it for the extended family? Certain piece of information you may say, you know, I'm just a bit uncomfortable about sharing this, and it's really not necessary for people to know about it. It doesn't have any bearing on anything, for example. That's a criteria to use.
Sure. In one case, you know, there's a set of parents, and it's in the family general knowledge that somebody's adopted, but they don't want it recorded in the genealogy. And my own feeling is that history is history is history, and if, in fact, that's a situation that should be acknowledged so that a child coming along later or somebody down the road...
Any way to put something in a time capsule and say 50 years down the road to reveal it?
And that was a question, was do you wait until after death? Or do grandchildren need to know that their grandmother was adopted if they needed to find something out historically? As I said, medical would be a great reason.
But this brings up an interesting point about the value of addressing family secrets rather than putting stuff under the rug automatically. For example, people often don't want a fact about adoption revealed because there's a certain stigma still attached to adoption. And yet,
right.
You know, as we go through these, you know, modern times, we are more and more destigmatizing things that are actually quite normal.
Right.
Adoption as a form of building family, for example, has been around for like generations.
Kurt, thanks very much for the call and continued good luck with your genealogical explorations.
I have one comment, which is that do we create stigma by hiding secrets? And I just want to leave you with that.
All right. We'll have to come back to that when we return from a short break. And we're also going to be discussing in the next segment of the program the difficulties being faced by the jury weighing the fate of sniper suspect Lee Boyd Malvo. The issues include youth, intimidation, and some awkward information about when was he lying. We'll be discussing that. You're listening to Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today, we're talking about the secrets families keep and what happens when they're disclosed and when they're not. Our guest is Jason Safran, a marriage and family therapist. He's with us from Berkeley, California. And I wanted to read an email. This is from Sharon in Encinitas, California. As a survivor of sexual abuse, this is a subject to which I've given much thought, and I've come to realize, she writes, that the truth is always the best choice. It can be painful, but it is the lie that is harmful, not the truth.
That is so true. That is so true. The lie carries such potential for shame to be attached to it, a sense of being flawed as a person. So to be able to speak the truth to people who will be able to hear you is very important to keep in mind, because you don't want to share stuff with people who really will just try to invalidate or minimize or deny. That makes it worse.
And one more email before we have to let you go. This from Matt in Portland, Oregon. My grandmother died 2 years ago when my family was going through her belongings. They found an envelope beneath the paper lining of a desk drawer. The letter was from a state home for the mentally retarded and informed my grandmother that her brother had died. No one in the family ever knew of this person's existence. It turns out my great-grandmother had the child out of wedlock, and when it turned out that he was challenged mentally, he was sent away to the state home. Discovering that a family member died alone in unknown circumstances was very hard news to receive. Even harder was how the news changed our perception of my grandmother, who kept the secret to her grave.
And I think it's important to grieve the loss of that family member. I would suggest having a memorial service for that family member so that the family can kind of come to terms and put to rest that person's memory.
Jason Safran, you've got to run, we know, because you've got another appointment you have to get to. We appreciate you taking the time to come and speak with us today.
Neil, it's a great pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity.
Jason Safran is a marriage and family therapist, co-director of the Center for Creative Growth in Berkeley, California. He was with us from the studios of Youth Radio in Berkeley.